What does the Lord want me to do? Humans share in common throughout history the quest to know and please God. And they ask, what does God want me to do? It's as old as Cain and Abel's fraternal rivalry over seeking God's pleasure, as old as Abraham grimly leading his son Isaac up the mountain. It's a question the disciples asked Jesus, what do you want us to do? Show us the way, O Lord, and we will follow. When we're young, we want to know what we should do with our lives, what job, what career, whether to marry a sweetheart. When we're in the middle of life's challenges, we wonder what to do with the complications that life can become. Opportunities come along that may never come again, and so do troubles. God, what do you want me to do in this situation? The answer's not always obvious. As we grow older, we wonder how to give our lives away. How shall we live in the golden years? And how shall we end our lives by living well? Lord, what do you want me to leave the next generation? Sometimes, like in these cases, the question is heartfelt response to God's guiding presence. But sometimes, like in the case of Micah 6, the same question is desperate appeal for relief. And it's more like, God, what do you want from me? The Lord's prophet Micah had called upon the people to change the way of their lives. The problem is, they've been living the way they're living for so long, they've lost imagination for what it's like to live in any other way. The way they're living isn't particularly working, but they don't know what else to do. What would you have me do? What does the Lord require of me? Micah is a harrowing book. Anyone who reads it may find themselves blurting out the same question. The prophet throughout the book is attacking the social evils of his day, the way the establishment is abandoning divine standards for self-interest, neglecting and even actively ill-treating the underprivileged. Micah lived in a period in which economic revolution had provided a mixed blessing. An influx of prosperity had spawned selfish materialism. A few successes in material action had swelled self-reliant pride. Religion was recast as the path to achievement of human desires. Personal and social values had all but eroded. Wealth was invested and reinvested in the land, with the result that the traditional system of agricultural small holdings as family farms collapsed into vast estates controlled by the wealthy few. Social concern was at the bottom of the list of priorities of national and local government officials. Even religious leaders did little more than assure God's continued blessing of their hollow prosperity. A good prophet, though, Micah declares a harrowing warning to anyone who would listen. You're in more trouble than you realize, and it's time to change the way you're living. I get the idea that old Kentucky Baptist farmer Wendell Berry saw the world with Micah-like eyes in the 1970s, when he wrote his poem, The Mad Farmer's Manifesto. The Mad Farmer's Manifesto is Berry's own beatitude-like poem for liberation from the soul-crushing pursuit of the world's empty promises. It's somewhat lengthy, but I think worth hearing in its entirety, so I'm going to read it. Love the quick profit, the annual raise, vacation with pay. Want more of everything ready-made. Be afraid to know your neighbors and to die. And you'll have a window in your head. Not even your future will be a mystery anymore. Your mind will be punched in a card and shut away in a little drawer. When they want you to buy something, they'll call you. When they want you to die for profit, they'll let you know. So friends, every day, do something that won't compute. Love the Lord. Love the world. Work for nothing. Take all you have and be poor. Love someone who does not deserve it. Denounce the government and embrace the flag and hope to live in that free republic for which it stands. Give your approval to all you cannot understand. Praise ignorance for what man has not encountered, he has not destroyed. Ask the questions that have no answers. Invest in the millennium. Plant sequoias. Say that your main crop is the forest that you did not plant, that you will not live to harvest. Say that the leaves are harvested when they've rotted into the mold, and call that profit. Prophesy such returns. Put your faith in the 2 inches of humus that will build under the trees every 1,000 years. Listen to carrion. Put your ear close and hear the faint chattering of the songs that are to come. Expect the end of the world. Laugh. Laughter is immeasurable. Be joyful, though you have considered all the facts. So long as women do not go cheap for power, please women more than men. Ask yourself, will this satisfy a woman satisfied to bear a child? Will this disturb the sleep of a woman near to giving birth? Go with your love to the fields. Lie easy in the shade. Rest your head in her lap. Swear allegiance to what is nighest in your thoughts. As soon as the generals and the politicos can predict the motions of your mind, lose it. Leave it as a sign to mark the false trail, the way you didn't go. Be like the fox, who makes more tracks than necessary, some in the wrong direction. Practice resurrection. Wendell Berry wrote this poem and a whole collection of poems as the Mad Farmer, and left his readers to wonder if he was mad as in angry, angry at the way the world has become and was conscripting all of its people into its grinding machinery, or whether he was mad as in a little crazy, a little off his rocker. And so we wonder about Barry what we might also wonder about the prophet Micah. What kind of mad was Micah? A little of both, perhaps. At least a little angry at what the people have become. At least a little crazy to think that people can change. But they can. And that's the whole point of this. Some prophecy is warning that you're cooked and there's no way out. Other prophecy is a warning that you're in big trouble, but there's still time to change. This is the latter, though they may not have understood it at first. In Micah 6, it might seem that all is lost. God calls the mountains as enduring witnesses against the people whom God calls to account, asking, "What have I done to you? How have I wearied you? Tell me, because I've been nothing but faithful to you. Remember the Exodus from Egypt from beginning to end. I was faithful. I was your God. And now look what you've become. Your mind is like it's in a little drawer. Your heart is too. Both sealed up, closed, shut away. You belong to the darkness now." And at this, Israel asks in desperate plea, "Okay, so what do you want from me? What does the Lord require of me?" And Israel is not without ideas about this and proceeds to offer a succession of proposals, each increasingly costlier than the one before. Shall I offer burnt offerings? Sacrifices in which the whole animal is completely consumed? God, do you want that? and there's only silence? Shall I offer year-old calves? Year-old calves, a much more costly sacrifice than the seven-day-old calves that could be offered. For a year by now, the calf's been fed, protected, cared for, maybe even loved. Is that what you want? And there's nothing but silence. Well, how about thousands of rams? And now the offer has become national. This is the kind of sacrifice only a king could make on behalf of a nation. Do you want that? And there's nothing but silence. Well, how about 10,000 rivers of oil? And now the offer has become global. I used to imagine that this was petroleum. Oil, black gold, Texas tea. But then I realized, this isn't that. They didn't even know that that was under there. This must be olive oil. 10,000 rivers of olive oil. And that's absurdly costly, but I think it points to even something bigger. That oil was used to anoint every sacrifice. Every sacrifice offered, anointed with just a small amount of oil, just a few drops sprinkled on every sacrifice that was offered. So how many sacrifices could be anointed with a river of oil? And what about 10,000 rivers of oil, if there were such a thing? The question they're asking is this: do you want the whole world sacrificed? Do you want everything? Would it be enough for you if we burn the whole world for you? And still, silence. And then finally, the move from impossibly costly to unthinkably ghastly. Is it my child, my firstborn you require? The fruit of my body for the sin of my soul. This, of course, is not what God requires. First, God never asks Israel to sacrifice its children. Some neighboring nations did this for their gods, but never Israel, and they knew that. And second, it says something that in their offer they have cleaved body and soul. The fruit of my body for the sin of my soul. Maybe there should be some allowance for poetic license here, and it does roll off the tongue, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul, but this is not their theology. And they knew that too, or they should have unless they forgot. They didn't have a theology or an anthropology that body and soul could be cleaved from one from another. And it's especially revealing that they seem to think their sin had just to do with their soul, like it was private within them, just between the individual and God. What it reveals is that they had conveniently developed a fundamental disconnect between religion, the soul, and living, the body. And here it finally reveals the root of the problem. They've forgotten that everything is bound together. Everything is spiritual. Your obligation to the good of the community is a spiritual matter. And how you care for the poor is also a spiritual matter. How you love your firstborn and everyone born after that is not the fruit only of your body, but also of your soul. Everything is spiritual. It's all of one. This last desperate attempt to win God's favor is not just a proposal to rip a child from her mother. It's a proposal to rip body from soul, to tear apart what God knit so wonderfully together from the beginning. And here I think, ironically, they've come finally to actual confession, though maybe they didn't even know what they were saying. If they could just listen to themselves, they would discover they've put into words what's at the root of everything they've become. They don't remember who they are. They've willfully forgotten, and they've forgotten everything in the process, everything that matters anyway. and still silence from God. And now what? What more can a person offer to atone for their sins than everything? What more can we do to please God but sacrifice everything we know and love? If that's not enough, then we have nothing left to offer, and we are truly indeed hopeless. We are doomed. I used to think that God finally broke God's silence in verse 8. I thought it was God who speaks. He has shown you, O man, what is good. But I don't think that anymore. I don't think God is the speaker. I think God is still silent. And so if God is still silent, who's talking? It might be Micah the prophet responding to the people's terrible ideas of self-justification. But what I'm really imagining is that the mountains, summoned at the beginning as witnesses in this courtroom, finally speak. The mountains, the enduring foundations of the earth, have seen it all. From Mount Sinai, where God made a people from a bunch of wanderers, to Nebo, where Moses looked over the promised land, to Carmel, where Elijah stared down the prophets of Baal, to Zion, adorned with God's temple, to the mountain where Jesus sat and taught the Sermon on the Mount, to the other one where Jesus was transfigured in pure glory, to the Mount of Olives with its Gethsemane garden watered by the tears of our Lord on the dark night of His arrest, to Calvary's cross-punctured memory, to the unknown mountain somewhere near Jerusalem, from which one day a round stone was hewed, which was then rolled in front of, and then miraculously away from, the entrance to a tomb one Sunday morning. The mountains have seen it all and bear faithful witness to the lives lived in their shadows. These enduring foundations of the earth have seen it all and been silent observers of everything that's happened under their watchful eyes. Until now. And now they speak. Into the awful silence that hangs between God and God's people, a gray-peaked elder of the hills speaks with a voice of rolling thunder. God has already shown you, O man. It's tempting and reasonable to make it gender inclusive. God has already shown you, O mortal, but we do lose something in the translation when we do. And I just want to point out, it's important to remember God calls them, all the people, all of them, God calls them collectively Adam. The ancient name of humanity's origin from the dust of the ground. The mountain reminds them where they've come from. God has already shown you, O Adam, what is good. And you've known it all along, but you've forgotten. And you've forgotten who you are. And you're living as if you created yourself, as if your life is your own, as if you're masters of the universe, but you are still Adam, and you're not even masters of the hills surrounding the valley. You're a creature shaped of dust, given life by the breath of God. And truly, you don't even know what you're saying when you invoke the unthinkable idea of giving up a firstborn as atonement for sin. But you will understand someday, but it will not be your firstborn. That day will come. Until that day, we along with all creation groan in travail, waiting. For now, God has already given you everything you need. A place, a rule of life, a community, and God's own love. God has already shown you what is good, to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk a little more humbly with your God. They already knew all this. It's a summary of what they've been told all along in just three little words: protect the vulnerable, live with open hands of mercy toward one another, be humble before God with every breath you take, do justice, love kindness, walk humbly with your God. It's a little mad to think that something this simple might just be the way forward for a people who've forgotten who they were made to be. But then again, we've tried everything else. Let those who have worn ruts in the paths of destruction try for a while the way of justice and mercy and humility. Those who do, somewhere along the way, may just discover what it means to practice resurrection. And they may just see God.